Good morning. I hope you are all enjoying this very fine weather that we've programmed for you. Unfortunately, I can't guarantee that it will last, so we will take advantage today. I'm very pleased to welcome you to what is the 26th in a series of Levy Economics Institute conferences on the state of the U.S. and the world economy. You will probably have noticed that I am not Dimitri Papadimitriou, who would normally have extended this welcome to you. Dimitri sends his regrets. He has other obligations, which you may or may not be aware of, and if you are not, I am not at liberty to reveal them to you. Nonetheless, he sends his best wishes for what has always been a very lively and open-ended discussion in the tradition of High Minsky, and I hope we are able to continue that long tradition. This year's conference takes place in an increasingly charged and divisive economic and political atmosphere. Sharp differences in approach are present within the new administration, within the majority party, and even within the opposition. It's a rather different environment than the one that we had envisaged when we were planning for this conference last September. I had originally proposed as a title, "The New Administration Meets the New Normal: Economic Policy for Secular Stagnation." This was an obvious attempt to hedge our bets on the outcome of the election. After the election, the first adjustment I made to the title was, "Can the new mercantilism displace the new normal, economic policy under the new administration?" As you can see, our title eventually adopted the elocution that was used in the presidential inaugural, "Pity on American First." My intention was really not to cause recollection of the old America First Committee of the pre-Second World War that attempted to encourage isolation on the part of the United States in the face of the emerging European conflict. Instead, it was rather to recall that the phrase America First, to my knowledge, was first used by Franklin Roosevelt during his first campaign for the presidency. At that time, Herbert Hoover had resolutely refrained from government intervention in support of the growing masses of the unemployed for fear of interfering with the operation of the market mechanism in producing recovery from what was presumed to be a temporary cyclical downturn. Recovery was just around the corner for his entire term. When this did not occur as expected, the blame was laid on foreign financial and political events eroding domestic confidence. For Roosevelt, Hoover's policy implied that farmers and workers must wait for general recovery until some miracle occurs by which the factory wheels will revolve again. But he went on to note that no one knows the formula for this miracle, and he instead argued in favor of direct measures to, and I quote, "restore prosperity here in this country by reestablishing the purchasing power of half of the people of the country. In this respect, I am for America First." Instead of the miracle of spontaneous market recovery, Roosevelt promised to take action to defend the condition of what came to be called the forgotten man by offering him a New Deal to protect from the ravages of bankers and industrialists. The simple substitution of America Great for New Deal suggests that there is an important similarity between the rhetoric and indeed the target audiences of the two campaigns. It is instructive that in both cases, the election was won with promises, creating a belief that appropriate action would be eventually forthcoming. We know from history how Roosevelt proceeded by experimentation, by trial and error, and by what at the time were considered audacious and radical economic policies. The question before us today is how the experimentation of the new administration may be directed to fulfill the campaign promises to bring about America First recovery. It was not the specific measures of the New Deal, which really did not even exist when Roosevelt first entered the White House, to restore purchasing power of farmers and workers, nor was it the organization by the federal government of the various alphabetized institutions. If anybody can remember the difference between the WPA and the PWA and everything else, you're doing much better than I am. To implement these measures that were audacious, Rather, it was the recognition and acceptance of the fact that the federal government bore responsibility to ensure the well-being of the population. The New Deal thus represented a fundamental change in the role of government as a permanent actor in the economy. In a phrase suggested to Roosevelt by Rexford Tugwell, the role of government was to provide the coordination of economic activity, to produce a reconciliation of diverse individual objectives in a coherent concert of interests, what Galbraith's gifted pen would eventually call countervailing power. This change was driven not by ideology. It's clear that Roosevelt, in fact, did not have one. Although he was a religious person, economically, he was not an ideologue. But was based on the recognition that the economic structure that had emerged from the First World War was no longer comprised of independent individual producers competing in free markets, but rather one of increasingly large corporations who dominated markets through Schumpeterian innovation, producing monopoly power as the normal state of affairs. In difference from Teddy the Trustbuster, who Roosevelt admired, the progressive movement, the New Deal recognized the crucial role of organizational ability of big business in increasing productivity, as well as the need to channel it to improve the conditions of the working man. Acting according to individual interests no longer guaranteed the greatest good for the greatest number. The price system in competitive markets no longer was the basic principle of organization and distribution. The problem was thus how to ensure the organization of the new productive structure to achieve socially and politically acceptable results. The driving force here was more Veblen than Keynes, although it's perhaps easier to understand the point in terms of the circular flowcharts that, interestingly enough, were very common in the discussions in that period. The simple proposition that firms' labor costs are in fact the source of the firm's sales, so that you have to balance both of these at the same time. The government was no longer to be the disinterested referee of classical liberalism, but would become a player to ensure the results promised by innovation under free enterprise. But it was not only the changing domestic economic structure that required a reconsideration of the role of government. The New Deal represented the democratic alternative to what we might call today the third way, seeking a political model that avoided both the fascist and the communist solutions that at the time appeared to be the most successful responses to the Great Depression and had substantial domestic political support on both sides. Not only was its role for government radical because of the international context and these two alternatives, but the reference point became these authoritarian alternatives. In this sense, the conductor's score for the proposed concert of interests, eventually embodied in the National Industrial Recovery Act, was quickly recast as a national plan, imposing centralized directives, voiding the operation of the free enterprise laissez-faire system upon which the great nation had been built. Indeed, most of the New Deal was built on executive orders creating new agencies to produce regulations designed to coordinate the opposing interests of labor and industry. What in current discussion is called the administrative state, the calls to remove regulations and agencies to liberate free market initiatives, were already very present in that period. The criticism was thus not of the measures taken to support the forgotten man. It was the fact that they were taken by the government. It became easy to make the argument against the pretense of knowledge rather than recognize the implications in the change and changing economic structure as the way to avoid the road to serfdom. But as Walter Lippmann pointed out in a book which he started at about that time called The Good Society, this criticism of the New Deal is based on the same error as those liberals who adopt John Stuart Mill's conclusion that, and I quote, laissez-faire, in short, should be the general practice. Every departure from it, unless required by some great good, is a certain evil. But for Lipton, the whole effort to treat laissez-faire as a principle of public policy and then to determine what should be governed by law and what should not be was based on so obvious an error in thinking that any aspect of work or of property is ever unregulated by law. In a community, there is no such thing. All freedom, all rights, all property are sustained by some kind of law. So the questions can never arise whether there should be law here and no law there, but only what law shall prevail. everywhere. He goes on to make the point that the defense of the laissez-faire system soon impedes freedom because it presumes, and again I quote, the prevailing social order is the only one that can be truly progressive. The regulations must not be confused with the aim of the true liberal, which must be to provide regulation that resolves the social problems created by changes in the productive structure of the economy. And again, I quote from Lippmann, by the whole unresolved task of educating great populations, of equipping men for a life in which they must specialize, yet be capable of changing their speciality, and of providing support for those who do not adapt themselves easily. Thus, we can give credit to the new administration's campaign for identifying a major problem facing a substantial share of the working population, while at the same time expressing doubts about whether it has recognized Lippmann's obvious error that simply eliminating regulations and reducing the role of government to provide individual freedoms for particular groups could remedy the secular stagnation from which they suffer. Now, I must admit that Roosevelt was also a convinced budget balancer. Some of you are, like me, old enough to recall Ronald Reagan's campaign, in which he channeled Roosevelt and also eventually followed Roosevelt's recantation in creating the ever-increasing budget deficits in his efforts to provide for what we call the sunrise economy. This is just another aspect of Lippmann's obvious lesson that has not been learned. Reducing the size of government is no more adequate than reducing regulation in achieving the promised objectives. Indeed, the failure of government to take on the responsibility to provide the necessary budget stimulus to support the purchasing power of households, in particular those holding underwater mortgages in the aftermath of the recent mortgage crisis, and in maintaining recovery is one of the major reasons for the secular stagnation that we currently face. The recent recovery is exemplary in being historically slow, but it is also one in which the contribution of federal support to the recovery has been declining. It is important to remember that besides the failure of Hoover's promised miracle recovery, there was not only a lack of purchasing power, but also what Roosevelt called a maldistribution of purchasing power. This was also a major theme of Roosevelt's campaign. As noted above, as the campaign progressed, the European financial crises and the decisions of the major European countries to go off gold became very important in explaining the failure of the appearance of the miracle of recovery. Yes, the confidence fairy was already present in the 1930s. It was also as difficult to discover as it is today. In his regard, note an anniversary that we celebrate today. Today is April 18. No one will remember. This is the date on which FDR gave his approval to the Thompson Amendment to the Agricultural Adjustment Act. Now, you may not remember what that did, but it gave the president the ability to take the U.S. off the gold standard, which he eventually did on June 5th. Note the important addition to the powers in the amendment that were included in the decision of June 5th, the suspension of the gold clause in private contracts. Roosevelt had been careful not to promise to maintain the gold standard per se, but his pledge to maintain a sound currency was so interpreted. But the action to suspend the gold clause eliminated any support for the New Deal in financial circles, and its suspension cemented the belief of those who thought that the president had taken on dictatorial powers by intervening directly in private contracts. We finally come to the problem of foreign trade and foreign policy, which was as disputed then as it is today. Here also, the influence of the new structure of production is important. In the interest of agricultural producers seeking foreign markets for their surpluses, met the production interests of manufacturing. It makes little difference if the reference is to Say's Law or Smith's Bakers and Candlemakers or Division of Labor and Innovation. They all depend on international reciprocity. Specialization imposes mutual interdependence. I quote from Hume, "I shall therefore venture to acknowledge that not only as a man, but as a British subject, I pray for the flourishing commerce of Germany, Spain, Italy, and even France itself." For a Brit, this is a major concession. This was Hume. One of the important aspects of the New Deal's concert of interests was that the orchestra was also composed of foreign as well as domestic players. And while they could not be expected to buy up all of the agricultural surpluses of the United States if they could not sell their manufacturers in competition with U.S. producers, if all countries were expanding, then all could sell more agricultural goods and manufacturers. Clearly, national self-sufficiency is a policy for a war economy, which is a planned economy. Trade restrictions, such as those that attempt to steal purchasing power from foreigners, are just as much an imposition on individual liberty as any other type of regulation. To this end, we will have two panels dealing with the impact of the Modern American First program on both our trading partners in Europe and those in South America. I should also signal that we have with us Paolo Savona, who has recently published a book called From the End of Laissez-Faire to the End of Liberal Democracy, which attempts to extend this dilemma to the international and global environment. The divisions and disputes that we contend today and which have contributed much to the current slow recovery find their source in the failure to recognize Lippmann's obvious error and the blind belief held by a large spectrum of the population that a reduction in regulation in the administrative state and in the role of government will somehow restore a laissez-faire market liberalism that never existed and is inappropriate to the changing structure of production in the United States and in the global economy. This reflects Keynes' conclusion in his general theory. The outstanding faults of the economic society in which we live are its failure to provide for full employment and its arbitrary and inequitable distribution of wealth and income. These are the areas in which government action is not only appropriate, but necessary. This is what Roosevelt recognized. And this is because, as Keynes says, the tacit assumptions of the classical analysis are seldom or never satisfied. It's interesting to note, then, that the problems that are faced by the new administration are so similar to those of the 1930s. Lack of sufficient fiscal support to employment, income inequality, and the management of external trade and payments. Those of you who follow the Levy Institute's publications will note the similarity between this characterization of the problems facing recovery from the Great Depression and those identified in recent issues of our strategic analysis. While it would not be appropriate to recommend New Deal policies to the current environment, it would be appropriate to note that the current battle cry of reducing the size of government of regulation risks repeating Lippmann's obvious error by failing to recognize the responsibility of government in dealing with the failure of social conditions to adapt to changing productive structures. In this regard, one cannot resist the opportunity to mention Hyminsky's proposal for an employer of last resort program as a modern substitute for the New Deal employment-creating measures that provides a remedy for both the problems of the government's fiscal support for expansion and the problem of personal employment. There's one final area of similarity with the experience of the New Deal that it's important to raise. As you know, Minsky was the architect and inspiration of this conference series. In his planning notes for the first conference, which was held in November 1991 under the title Restructuring the Financial Structure of Economic Growth, Minsky emphasized the importance of structural reform of the financial system as the prerequisite for more sustainable growth and employment. That conference took place in the aftermath of a major real estate crisis that produced considerable changes in the institutional structure of the financial system, some through the purging of unsustainable institutions, others through regulatory and legislative responses. Minsky's idea was to bring economists from the academy and professionals and officials facing issues in private finance or in regulatory public policy to the Levy Institute to discuss a new institutional framework. At that time, the discussion was centered on the attributes of universal banks relative to bank holding companies and whether it would be appropriate to allow non-financial corporations ownership of financial institutions. Haye contributed to this discussion with a number of policy pieces, most of which were not published, but are available on the Minsky Archive through the Institute's website, and I urge you to consult them if you have not done so. In looking at these papers, you will see that Haye, despite my best efforts, was not attracted by the universal banking model, of which I was increasingly favorable, having spent a great deal of time in Europe. He instead opted for an adaptation of the bank holding company model in which each subsidiary dealing with a particular banking function would be separately capitalized from the holding company itself. This approach has more recently been under discussion in the Lawson Report and the idea of what was there called ring fencing. Tom Honig his recent proposal reflects some of these ideas, and I presume tomorrow morning he will be advancing a further discussion of these ideas. But Hai's discussion really went beyond barriers or fences to deal with the problem of deposit insurance, suggesting that while insurance might be maintained, he was not convinced that this was a good idea, much as Roosevelt was not convinced it was a good idea, it would be most appropriately applied, Hai suggested, to the asset side of the ring-fence subsidiary than to its liabilities, that is, providing insurance to the risky investments that the banks made. The idea here was to support the risk-taking function of the banks while defending the safe security payment system. He was also, in this regard, in favor of the introduction of community banks and organized a Levy project in that direction. Esther George, I think, has also been recently interested, who is speaking this morning, in that particular topic, and it's one that the Institute has taken a continuing interest as a response to the changing, the required change in institutional structure. By the end of the 1990s, Hai was no longer with us, but the debate on the economy's financial structure was again at center stage. Unable to cope with a continuing crisis in mortgage financing, created by the disappearance of the traditional savings and loan banks and the continuous blurring of the strict Glass-Steagall lines of division between what were commercial banks in name only and investment banks, which had largely encroached on the retail payment system. Banks took on universal functions, but within a holding company structure, absent the separate capitalization of the subsidiaries that Hai had proposed. We all know the results of this silo-type structure in which it became increasingly difficult for managers and regulations to understand the overall risk exposure and the resources available to meet potential losses. The regulatory response to the failure of this structure has been a push for higher and higher regulatory capital in the hope that there will be enough to cover resignation that the system will continue to produce ever higher losses. In addition, regulators have imposed liquidity requirements in the form of asset characteristics. But as Hai, following Keynes, had pointed out long ago, there is no characteristic of assets called liquidity. The ultimate source of liquidity is the ability to convert an asset into a means of payment. And this depends on the issuer's access to the regulated banking system and of the banks to the Fed's discount window. Unfortunately, in an attempt to shield taxpayers from loss and constrain the Fed's independence to act in crisis, Dodd-Frank has sought to limit this crucial aspect of systemic liquidity that traditionally has resided in Section 13 of the Federal Reserve Act. But the most important point is that despite Dodd-Frank, the overall financial structure has remained basically unchanged. I am sure that Hai would have considered this a mistake, noting that the push to higher capital ratios would eventually lead the system closer and closer to a system of 100% reserve banking, which would eventually neuter the ability of the financial system to undertake the risky financing that he always believed was required to fund the productive capital structure of the system. I think he would also have noted that the liquidity of assets is determined by the willingness and ability of regulated banks to take them on their balance sheets in exchange for more liquid liabilities. 100% banks cannot do this. It is interesting that we are now starting to see criticisms, such as in the recent farewell speech of Fed Governor Tarullo, of aspects of the Volcker Rule reducing the liquidity of financial markets. Given that we all know that dealer spreads and minimum size in all markets that are dealer markets require on the dealer's capital, it should not be surprising that higher capital requirements and higher liquidity requirements are in essence mutually contradictory. So we are back to the initial question that Hai faced, how to change the institutional structure of choosing between the Hensarling emphasis on capital requirements as providing a free pass on banking activities to refining the holding company structure, as in the Honig proposal, or Elizabeth Warren's return to Glass-Steagall. All three proposals are currently in front of Congress, and I am sure we will hear further discussion of these issues during the conference. As in past years, we invite you to take a look or to take with you some of our publications that are available at the desk in the back of the room. We very much welcome your comments. This year, there is an important addition. 3 years ago, the Institute started offering a 2-year Master of Science in Economic Theory and Policy. Last year, the first graduating class closed out their year by launching a blog with the title, The Minskys. You will also find a print of some of their contributions in the desk on the back of the room. And we are extremely proud of the way in which they have been able to absorb the thinking of High Minsky in their training during our master's program. We welcome you. Enjoy the conference. Enjoy the nice weather. Enjoy the beautiful gardens. We hope you will find the presentations and discussions thoughtful. I again express Dmitry's regrets for not being able to be with us today, and I thank you very much for your attention.